Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview with Donald Chan, the musical director for the production of West Side Story at the Oslo Repertory Theatre, and who is the musical director for West Side Story productions all over the world. Donald's story is interesting in and of itself. He is a charming, rather self-deprecating, incredibly talented man. And in this show, I'm not only going to play Donald's interview and Pam Wiley's review of West Side Story, but as much of the music as I can cram in. So hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources, oh,
and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being who you really are, not some facsimile, not some person you think you're supposed to be or other people told you you're supposed to be, but who you really are. And as I said in the run-up, today's show is all about the production of West Side Story at the Oslo Repertory Theatre Company. And I'm sure that most of you recognize the music underneath my introduction to the show today. It is, of course, the prologue to West Side Story, so famous that it's recognizable only with a couple of notes and a couple of finger snappings. So I'm not going to talk very much today because I not only want to air Donald's interview and Pam's review, but as much of the credible music from West Side Story as I can. So we're going to start out with the song America, in which the Puerto Rican women talk about the dilemma of losing their country and the hope for their new country. Leonard Bernstein's music is just extraordinary, and a very young Stephen Sondheim shows what he's going to be doing in the future in songs like America. So America, followed by my interview with Donald, followed by another song, followed by the review, and hopefully yet another song. Okay, here, America, by Leonard Bernstein and Stephen Sondheim.
Puerto Rico, you lovely island, island of tropical breezes.
Here with Donald Chan, and Donald is here as the musical director for the current production of West Side Story at Oslo Repertory. And as I understand it, this is the umpteenth time that he has musical directed West Side Story. I am explaining that I interview people who make their living or their life within art. And it's probably a fair guess that you make your living and your life with the art of music. Would that be accurate?
Of course.
Of course? Okay, good. So I only ask one question. Mm-hmm. And it is, do you remember, can you tell me, the very first moment in your life when music became important, attractive, compelling?
Well, I started piano when I was 4 years old.
Four?
Yeah.
And you started at four because?
My parents took me to this wonderful lady who was supposed to be the best person in San Jose, California. And she said I was ready to take lessons, and I sat down and played a little bit, and she says,
Well, wait a minute. Were you playing before?
Well, I was noodling at the keyboard, probably, and Yeah.
Do you remember, or you just heard this?
I sort of remember sort of noodling around, because my parents had a piano there.
Mm-hmm.
So she said I was ready to take piano lessons, and so I was working on the keyboard, and at 8 I gave my first recital.
Okay, back up a little bit for me. Was there music in your house? Did your parents play?
Yeah, my dad had a, well, he's a dentist. He was a dentist, and he had a dance band when he was in college. My mother sang, so there was music.
There was a lot of music there, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Did either one of them play the piano, or they just happened to have it?
My mother sort of played the piano. My dad sort of played the piano, too, so... But they had the keyboard there all the time. It was sort of interesting because my brother, they took my brother to see her at 5, and she said that he wasn't ready to play piano yet.
Really?
Yeah.
Is he older or younger than you?
He's younger than me. And then when he was in third grade, he started playing piano.
Do you know what it was that she heard that suggested that?
Well, he said probably something about the coordination that wasn't right at that time. So
at 4, mm-hmm. she saw that you had the coordination to play.
Yes.
Do you remember the beginnings? Do you remember meeting her or starting to play? Or
a little bit. And I remember when I first played, not publicly, but I played, maybe 5 years old. I remember I had to sit on the keyboard and I had to put my foot on a pedal that was attached to the pedal so that I could reach a pedal. And so those are the first things I remember. And I remember going to concerts and I also remember there was a string quartet playing that my aunt took me to sit here. And, you don't usually don't clap at the end of movements. Well, I did. And so everybody looked at me and I said, well.
So, you're 4, you're 5, you're 6. Do you remember practicing? Do you remember liking it or caring about it?
I sort of liked it, but I wanted to play baseball and do all the other things too. So.
Yeah. And so did you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I played basketball, and I'm pretty much an avid tennis fan right now, mm-hmm. and a tennis player.
Okay, so it wasn't a calling so much as it happened to you. I mean, you know, you noodled, they brought you there. She said, okay, he can learn, and you did,
yeah.
essentially.
Right.
So you must have had some kind of facility, I mean, some kind of...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was 8 years old, I heard, some Tchaikovsky, and I wanted to conduct. You know, I remember playing a record and standing in front of the record player and conducting. And
had you seen a conductor before? How did you know about conducting?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's just I had been seeing a lot of different things musically, so
yes,
it's just all incorporated.
Yeah. So, did you say now I'd like to conduct?
No, but I remember my dad watched me conducting in front of the phonograph.
Yes.
As I was listening to music, so that's it. And then, as the years went by, I had a normal childhood. I played basketball, I played tennis, and I gave concerts. And then I pulled away from classical music, and I had a rock and roll band in high school, and I had a singer that sang like Little Richard. And then. I played jazz,
mm-hmm.
and I played...
So now, were you having lessons in all this all
oh,
along?
Oh, yes, uh-huh.
So you had lessons in rock and roll?
No. In classical music, I had a professor at San Jose State where I was taking lessons as well.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, he said, well, what do you want to do? I said, well, I love playing rock and roll, I love playing jazz. And,
mm-hmm.
And he said, well, there's a possibility you can get your master's at Juilliard. So, but you have to work on your facility to be. So I had to develop two different types of techniques, one for classical music, one for rock and roll.
Really?
Yeah. There's a facility of playing classical music, and there's a facility playing jazz.
Can you explain a little bit?
Well, it's the way of going at the technique, because there, in rock and roll you're just pounding the piano.
That's right.
And in classical music you have to have a certain touch to get certain sounds out of the keyboard, and I had to work on that to get that under my control.
And jazz?
Jazz is combining all the...
Yes, it's both, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, you need to know when to pound and when
right.
to finesse, right?
right?
Well, okay. So, how old were you when you decided you wanted to try and go to Juilliard?
I was working on my bachelor's in San Jose State, but I had a crazy life because I was playing gigs in San Francisco, and coming back home and getting my 4 or 5 hours of sleep and then going to school and doing other sorts of things.
So, were you majoring in music?
Yeah. I was majoring in dentistry first because I thought I was going to be follow my dad as a dentist. So, about the second year, I said, no, I don't think that's for me.
Well, I'm actually curious about that, about when you was it that you decided dentistry wasn't for you or that you missed the music?
Both.
Really?
And there was a certain contest that, you try out for soloists to be presented with the symphony, and then I won an audition with the San Jose Symphony, and it was that time that the Bernstein officers heard about my doing something because I was premiering his Bernstein second piano concerto at the time.
Really?
Had not been done in the West Coast. So they said, "Who's this kid that's gonna?" So they heard about it, and they wanted to hear a tape of it, and so they knew about me at that time, I guess. And then later on, as I was doing, I got into musical theater. I was conducting. I loved conducting, as I said. So.
Wait! Did you study conducting ever?
At the Juilliard, after I finished the...
Okay, back up now. So we have you in, you're an undergraduate now.
Yeah.
You're majoring in dentistry. At some point, you have the epiphany, no dentistry, music, right? So you shift to major in music as an undergraduate.
Right.
And it's there that the teacher says to you, you could get your master's at Juilliard if you bone up, if you get your technique underground.
Right.
So then you focus on that.
Yeah, and then I got into, I did some conducting at the meantime as well. So I finished at San Jose State and went to take my tests at Juilliard. And it was crazy because, their tests were in November. I mean, they started classes late. And so if I didn't get in, I would be sort of out in the cold because other graduate schools have already started already.
Yes.
So I took all the tests and I guess I got in. You know, they had some crazy tests that they said, because you didn't graduate from Juilliard for your undergrad, you have to take all these undergraduate classes. And I said, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to pass out of them. I'm going to bone up and study. And so I mastered all the classes and passed out all the classes. You know, these kind of tests where they drop the needle on the record and they say, what period is it from, who's the composer and all that sort of stuff, and I aced them. So.
So is that because you had studied that or just because you knew it or because you had listened?
Both, because as I was growing up, I went through a lot of the concerts at San Francisco Symphony and did a lot of playing, and I knew the repertoire, and so I sort of knew the periods and the music.
Are you underplaying your skill here a little bit?
What?
I mean, it is, I think it's pretty remarkable. I mean, no?
I don't know. I'm just I am what I am.
Yes, I got it. Okay, so you ace all these undergraduate courses that they make you take at Juilliard and on the master's level.
Yeah.
And so then you study.
Yeah, I studied with James Friskin, who was one of the premier teachers there. And then at the same time, I was a good improviser. So I got a partial scholarship, but I had to earn some money. So I was a good improviser, so I played ballet classes there. And I was for a lot of the classical people. And then I was still interested in music theater, so I got I interviewed for an off-Broadway show to be a musical director, and I said, sure, why not? And so it was a bomb, but I had the experience of doing it on an off-Broadway show.
Wow. And how old were you?
22. 22, I guess. I don't know.
Right. And so, did you know what you wanted to do then? I mean...
Well, I was going to go after anything that came along my way. You know, I love playing piano, but I love conducting more. I love theater more. And so if I was going to be in an orchestra or music theater, that's what I was going to follow through with.
Okay, so what did you do?
That first summer, I went up to Cohasset, Massachusetts, and became an assistant conductor for a summer theater.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next year, I went to, I got my off-Broadway show, and then I started to figure out what else I was going to do, and then I got married. And also I got a scholarship to work on my doctorate at the University of Colorado.
Ah.
So, and then that took me 8 years to finish.
Really?
Because I went to Earlham College and took an assistant professorship there. And then I got a call from the outdoor theater, St. Louis Missive Opera Company, which is probably the largest outdoor music theater in the United States. It has 13,000 seats and a big orchestra, which was 35 at that time, 250 depending upon the show they were doing. And that theater has, as I said, 13,000 seats. The last 2,000 seats up in the way up there were free. So people used to come and bring their picnic bags and have a picnic before the show started. But I remember seeing a show up way up there, and they looked like ants on the stage. Anyway, I was there for 2 years, and then I got the possibility of being the full conductor there.
Oh.
And then the first year was very good for me because I showed them I could handle the position. And actually, it's an interesting position because you do 10 shows in 12 weeks.
My goodness.
And
oh my goodness.
Yeah, and so the first 3 weeks you...
All musicals.
All musicals. The first 3 weeks you teach the company all the big musical numbers.
For all 10
shows?
For
all 10 shows.
Good
and
grief.
And then the fourth week you start the first show. And you go bum, 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 all the way down the line.
My goodness.
Yeah, so that's where I got my big repertoire to do music theater.
I'll bet you did.
I think I've got something like a repertoire of about maybe 75 or 80 shows under my belt.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Was there a repertory company for the actors?
No, we brought in a Broadway actors to do the principal parts. And we hired something like 24 singers and then 16 dancers, and that was their basic company, and then we brought the principals in from New York.
Whew.
And then it was a hectic schedule because there's no day off. For 12 weeks, we do 7 nights of shows.
Good grief.
While we're doing one show, we're rehearsing the next show during the day.
Right.
And then the dress rehearsals are always on Saturday night from midnight to 4 o'clock in the morning. And so after 4 o'clock, we all go out and have breakfast, sleep to about 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, and then I'd have an orchestra rehearsal with the next company Sunday afternoon, and then finish the previous show that Sunday night. Monday morning, start the next show, principals come in, and get ready for the opening night for the next show.
The principals come in, and then the next day they open?
No, the principals come in for the next show.
Oh, so then you're going into rehearsal.
Yeah, so
with that one, right? I got
overlapping.
Right.
Every show. So.
My goodness.
Yeah.
You have to be young.
Yeah.
I mean, for one thing, you're not getting very much sleep.
That's true. So, and then.
But it is what you say. It's
right.
It's you know, learning.
Test your mental. You know, it's a test you what you can do and how much you can handle.
Yes, and did you love it?
Oh yeah, I was there for about 10 years.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I
see. How many shows did you say you got on your
belt? About 75, 80 shows.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That is amazing. Okay, so then how old were you when you ended that?
I was in, let's see, I must be about 35, 40 maybe.
Then what did you do?
Then in the meantime, I was assistant professor at Evergreen State College, and it was a brand new school. That was opening up in the state of Washington. And I applied for it, and they said, well, actually, there's no assistant professor. You're all professors as you go, because they have a different system for grade. There are no grades. You have to write reports of the students, how they're doing.
Ooh.
And you get adjudicated every 2 years to see if they want to keep you on.
And
so I was there for 10 years. And then I got tired of that. I think I got tired of fighting the faculty meetings. You know, it just got tiring. And just, I wanted to teach.
I was going
to
say, right.
You know, and they just argue. And I said, you know, this is not the way of teaching.
Right.
So I had a friend in New York who said, there's a tour going out of Woman of the Year with Lauren Bacall. And if I wanted to do it, and I said, of course, I'll do it. And so I met them in Los Angeles and happened to hitch up with that show. And then other shows came along. I did La Cagliostro, Phantom of the Opera. And then I got my Broadway production of Cabaret with Joel Grey.
Wow.
And then in the meantime, while I was doing Cabaret, I got a call from the Cleveland Opera Company to do a production of West Side Story.
And when was that?
That was 1985, I think it was.
Oh, my goodness.
And so that was a very important production for me, because the Bernstein's office sent people out to see the show.
Wow.
And I didn't think much of it. And then a couple of years later, they were doing a national tour of West Side Story, which I was on the top of the list to do, because everything had going into New York for a revival, but that never happened because something, I don't know, they couldn't get the theater, or they had, you know, something. So I did that, and then other shows came along, and then I kept doing West Side Story and other shows evolved. And then 2000, Joey and I met to do a production of West Side Story at La Scala. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I was doing that, because the Bernstein office says, well, you've been doing all these West Side Story productions, then we'd like you to do it, head it out. There was one hitch, though, at the Scala. The opera company wanted Chang Yang-moon to conduct the show, because he was a favorite of theirs at the Scala. And he said, you fly out to meet him in Paris, because he's going to be there and wants you to meet with you. So I go and meet him, and he says, I want you to teach me the show. I said, I beg your pardon.
Really?
Yeah. He says, you have to go to rehearsals to learn the show. I can't just teach you the show. You have to go to see the show to rehearse it. And he says, I don't want to do the rehearsals. I just want to do opening night and then whatever.
Good grief.
So I got a call. I called the Bernstein office, and they said, he will be fired. He's not going to do the show. We want you to do the show.
Wow.
So that was my first introduction. And Joey, that was his first production of West Side Story. And he was a little, he was very rambunctious, you know, and he didn't know the show very well, but he knew the dances.
Mm-hmm.
So I had known the show very well, so we worked everything out together, and he did a marvelous job, and everything worked out, and the first opening was a big sellout. And actually, when they first heard about the first preview that we did, there was a line around the block too.
Wow.
And I was nervous because I heard that the opera orchestra will play for you if they don't like you. They don't. They will just look at you and they just go play with their instruments, and they said, okay, whatever. But we got along very well, after the intermission, the first night, I came back into the house, and they were stamping their feet. I said, is that an uproar that you don't want me to bow?
Really?
And somebody told me, said that if they stamp their feet, they like you.
Oh, God.
So that was, we were very happy about that. Oh. And then we went back in 2003, and at that, the first one, near 2000, we had the second orchestra. And so the first orchestra heard that they were coming back, so they all wanted
they
it.
They wanted it.
And so that was another success that we had. And then from then on, Joey and I had been together to do a company had bought them out to make sure that they wanted to carry this production around Europe and Asia. And since 2003, Joey and I have been going
traveling over. Traveling with West Side Story.
Yeah, right. And getting new companies and making sure that it's done the right way. And the Verse Art Office has been very happy with what has been done.
As is Oslo Rep. It's a wonderful production.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. So this is your avocation at the moment,
right? Yeah,
I think
so. This is my coming, whatever it is.
Yes, right. It has all sort of led to this, right?
Yeah, right.
Right. So where do you go from here? Do you know?
Yes, we have the production company in Europe has started to put together a tour that will start with Europe and Asia in middle of 2016.
Wow.
It'll be a year tour, they say. So we'll probably play some of the major opera houses like we did last time. And we're always going, when we go to Japan, we always play the big houses there.
Mm-hmm.
So and Australia, too.
Wow. So do you want to say anything about the show itself? I mean, what is difficult about it, or what is mostly pleasurable about it, or?
Well, I mean, I've been with this musical forever, and it never gets tiring because the music's so wonderful.
The music is wonderful.
And the hardest thing to do is put a company together that is young and vibrant and full of energy that will match up to what the show wants.
What it deserves.
Right.
Right,
so
yeah.
That's always difficult. We always have a hard time finding an Anita. Always find a hard
God,
time.
You did amazingly this time.
Yes.
Oh,
and
she's...
And Tony and Maria, they're wonderful.
They're wonderful.
You know? But, you know, sometimes they get a little long in the tooth and we say, well, I'm sorry, you can't use it anymore. You know, they just...
You mean people who have done it.
Yeah, right.
And they
want to
do it again.
And
right.
They said, you know, you're just getting too old to do the show.
Oof, yeah. So, well, what's ironic to me about this is that neither you nor Joey can get too old. You know, you can go on doing this. Well, all right. Do you have a favorite song in the show?
Oh, the ballet is wonderful. I mean, and When Hand Went Hard and the balcony scene, they're all pretty much my favorites.
Yeah, the ballads.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because they're quite beautiful.
Yeah. And it has to be, if it's not done right, I just hate it. You know, and if the Tony can't get that B flat and he can't phrase it the right way, it just becomes a downer for me.
Yes, I'm sure. And it must be like chalk on the board, you know. Do you know what I mean? Hearing
yes,
it
I know.
And having it be wrong.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so this is so interesting to me. So you must, when you audition, ask them to do it. Ask them to sing the notes. So they, theoretically, they can do it in audition, but they can't always pull it off in performance. Is that?
Yes, it happens that way sometimes, you know. I mean, in the auditions, we have them sing it several times just to make sure that the B flat is there and it's solid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if they can do it three times, they should be able to do it.
Right. And they're professionals, that you use, so it's not,
yeah,
we're not talking
her. Yeah.
Because sometimes the voice will desert you.
Oh, yeah.
Even if you...
But when we're traveling in Europe, we carry we have two Tonys and two Marias.
Really?
Yes.
Very clever.
Well, because of the fact that we've had problems, we were at in Paris at the, I can't remember the name, opera house. We had one Tony who just couldn't make it, and so the other Tony came in and nailed it. So we just are concerned that we have to make sure that the production goes on. We can't.
Yeah, no, yeah. You don't want, that's a moment in the show when everybody's holding their breath. They don't, you know, really, you can't.
Right.
I mean, there are other things that could probably be glossed over without necessarily ruining it, but that's not one of them.
Especially when we're in opera houses, we can't...
Yes.
You know, like Berlin Opera House or any of the big opera houses, they expect your production to go on no matter what. So if we don't have a Tony that's going to be viable, that's forget it.
So what you carry two, is it the A team and the B team, or they interchangeable?
No, they interchange. I mean, we never know we never tell them who's going to go on and off.
Really?
So they're always...
They always have to be up.
That's
they
right.
always have to be ready.
Right.
Oh, my God.
So when we're in Milan, we had a different producer at that time. He says, we're not telling him who's going to go on opening night. So, until the day before.
Wow.
So that kept them really
I'll bet. To warm up. Really? Oh my God. Yeah. Amazing. So are there any other stories about these productions? I mean, there have been so many of them.
Oh, well, you know, we have different audiences and different the way they applaud. The Japanese are very quiet when they applaud, but they go crazy at the end of the...
Really?
Yes. They wait for you at the stage door to come out.
So, oh, amazing.
Like stars, you know, rock and roll stars. This is really fun. But other places, you know, in Europe, they understand the show quite a bit.
I was just going to say, is there a language issue?
But there is. We do have overhead monitors.
You do in the opera house with the language
right.
that it's in, right?
Right.
And, wow, that's amazing.
In Italy, they have in the back of the seats now.
Really?
Yeah, so you can see the translation in the back.
Right in front of you.
And you can do it, they have buttons that you can see it in English, Italian, or French, or whatever.
Wow.
Which is very interesting.
It's very interesting, but I don't know, for me...
It takes your eyes off the stage.
I was just going to say that, right? Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking. They're not watching it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if it's on the stage, then... Like in an opera house, you know, you can see what everybody's doing, and you look up and see what they're saying. But
in Japan, they do that, and
in Italy, they don't care if you don't see the
actors. I don't know, but in Germany, they have it on the stage, above. But that was only in Milan.
It's very odd.
Yeah,
I mean, I guess that they couldn't give you the opportunity to change the language if it was on the top of the stage, because that would be
right.
That would be a little confusing,
right.
But. Still, it seems very odd.
Yeah.
I mean, God, that's very strange.
But other opera houses, like in San Carlo a couple of years ago, and they had it in the top of the house.
Yeah.
So. Oh, also, we have, in our travels in Europe, we do use the full orchestra.
You take the whole orchestra?
No, we have an orchestra that comes in from either from... the Ukraine or Lithuania.
Really?
Yes, or Hungary, because they can travel with us. And the others, if we hire orchestra from the locals, sometimes it's very expensive to do that.
More expensive than traveling a company?
Yes, right.
I mean, traveling a whole orchestra?
And I also have six musicians from the United States.
That you take with you?
Yeah. Whew. Yeah, I have a drummer,
mm-hmm.
and a bass player, and a keyboard person. And the first trumpet player, and two reed players. Because the reed players, three reed players, one, three, and four. Reed one plays flute, alto, piccolo, clarinet. Reed three plays flute, clarinet, alto sax, no, tenor sax, bass clarinet, barry sax, and oboe, and English horn. And reed four plays bass sax, tenor sax, soprano sax, flute, piccolo, and bass clarinet. So
they're busy picking up the instruments and putting them down and picking them up and putting them down, right?
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Sorry, I haven't seen that. That must
well,
be something.
And when we were in Milan, we had a place for each of those musicians. And so that we had a woodwind section that had about 10 musicians instead of having just...
Not everybody having to double and triple and quadruple, right?
Oh, yeah, right. So it's hard to find those kind of musicians. So
kidding.
We have to go to the United States to make sure that we bring in all those people that
just in case.
Right.
Wow, that's amazing and lucky guys.
Yeah, they get a chance to travel the world.
That's right, and play the same gig over and over again. It's pretty amazing.
I think the best orchestra we had was from Japan.
Really?
Yeah, I went to my first rehearsal in Japan was scheduled for 8 hours. I was done in two. And they are fabulous musicians.
Because they just read like this,
right? Like that. And it's so funny. If they make a mistake, they keep playing. They raise their hand and say, "I made the mistake," and they keep playing.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yes.
Wow. So you've learned so much, haven't you?
Yes, definitely.
I mean, this whole career has been an education in a way.
Definitely. You know, I'm still learning, too. I mean, you know, as to way people are.
And yes, different cultures,
right.
different
right.
expectations, right? It's wonderful. So I only ask one other question, and it is, having given a life, and you have given a life to this work, I mean, since you were four, right, really? Mm. Would you say something about what that's like?
Hmm. How can I say this except it's been interesting? You know, I don't think I would have had it any other way. I mean, I've enjoyed everything I've done, and I don't know if I would have done anything differently, you know.
You're glad you weren't a dentist.
Right. definitely.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, because even though you said that you had a regular boy's life and you played, you know, sports and all that, it really sounds as though music was a through line for you.
Yes.
And so it's interesting that you even considered being a dentist. I mean, not following that.
Well, I think it's because, you know, my dad wanted, I think my dad wanted me to be the dentist.
He did.
Yeah. My brother became the dentist.
I was just going to say, I bet that's true. Right.
My brother became the dentist, and my dad made my dad happy. But my brother didn't want to become a dentist.
Oh.
So, but he followed the trade, and also he said when he graduated dental school, he says, you know, I want to travel, because he had won a scholarship to go to Paris to learn French in the second year of Berkeley, mm-hmm. California. So when he graduated, he took the money that was given to him, borrowed the money from the bank, because he, you know, they usually, at that time, they could borrow money to open their own practice in the dentistry.
Really? Oh, so he took the money that was supposed to open his practice.
He took the money and opened a travel agency.
You're kidding.
No. He opened a travel agency and he says, no, I hate being behind the desk. He sold the travel agency and became a purser for Pan Am.
Wow.
So, and along the years, now he's with United Airlines, and he works 3 days flying, and the other 3 days he is a dentist.
You're kidding.
No.
That's hilarious. So finally your father got a dentist.
Yep.
Amazing.
Traveling dentist.
A traveling dentist. Yes. And a traveling musician.
Yes, right.
It seems clear to me, even if it wasn't clear to you, that musician was what you always were. I mean, even that teacher saw it immediately, right?
Yeah. No, I was very lucky. You know, I could have, who knows?
It doesn't sound like you could have done anything else, actually.
That's true.
You know, right. Well, that was wonderful. Is there anything else you'd like to say about this production for people who might be on the fence about seeing it, although I can't imagine how they could be?
I would say this is the production that one should see, because people who see this show will see as close to the original that Robbins and Bernstein would have loved to have.
That's a lovely thing. That's a lovely thing. We're very grateful to have you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
The Lynn Show is about being who you really are. And in Donald Chan, we hear the story of a man who always knew who he really was. And the conflict that so many of us have existed in Donald's life. He wanted to please his father. He wanted to be who his father wanted him to be. And yet, he could not deny who he really was. And luckily for Donald, and luckily for us, his passion to be who he really is won out. I can't imagine that his father is sorry. Certainly, the entire world benefits from the fact that Donald had the courage to be himself. And as is always true when I play an interview with someone who makes their living or their life with an art, I am hoping that you are asking yourself, did I know who I was? Did I make a choice against who I am in order to please someone? Is it working for me? Are you feeling about your life the way Donald is feeling about his? You don't have to be famous. You don't have to make a lot of money with your passion. Being who you are makes all the difference. So, if you can't answer, yes, I wake up every morning deliriously happy that I am doing what I am doing. And if you can't say, I chose me, if you are still saying, I chose what someone else wanted for me, or what someone else wanted me to be for them, it's not too late to recover what you may have lost. And if you want to talk about that, you can find me at my website, thelynshow.com. That's thelynnesshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. Email me anything you want to say. You can also get me to come and speak to your group or organization. You can get my book. You can listen to all the shows I have ever done. So now, I'm going to play two of what I consider to be the most beautiful songs ever written. Next up is Tonight, followed by Pam Wiley's review of the Oslo production of West Side Story. So now, Leonard Bernstein and Stephen Sondheim's glorious music, sung gloriously by Carol Lawrence and Larry Kurt, Tonight.
You're the only thing I see forever. In my eyes, in my words, and in everything I do, nothing is but you, ever.
And there's nothing for me but Maria. Every sight that I see is Maria. Always you, every thought I'll ever know. Everywhere I go, you'll be you and me.
Tonight, tonight, it all began tonight. I saw you and the world.
On opening night, the excitement in the air was palpable. You could feel it all around you, insistent that the production get started so we could once again hear the irresistible rhythms and syncopation of Leonard Bernstein's pulsating music, watch the astounding dance scenes reproduced by Joey McNeely from Jerome Robbins' original choreography, listen to the rich lyrics by Stephen Sondheim, with the story of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet transposed in a book by Arthur Lorentz to the world of New York gangs. The curtain went up, and there we were in the red brick warehouse world of New York's Upper West Side, where a Puerto Rican group of young men, the Sharks, were trying to take over the area, causing the Caucasian young men, the Jets, to take up a small but brutal stand against them. Soon, the dancers' feet were establishing the insistent, strong beat of this battleground neighborhood. Such a dazzling sight to watch. Amazingly talented dancers and singers whose language told the tale with brilliance through the production. We were cheering at the end of the first scene. Suddenly, we are in the midst of a young, burning romance between Tony, nicely played by Mark Koeck, a former leader of the Jets, and Maria, beautifully sung by Jenna Burns. Maria's brother, Bernardo, is the leader of the Sharks, powerfully sung and danced by Andres Acosta. The romance is cautiously supported by Anita, portrayed with high spirit by Mary Antonini. Only when she is physically abused by members of the Jets does she tell of the lover's plan to go away. The Oslo Reps production is splendid. Huge kudos to Joey McNeely for keeping the choreography and for casting such outstanding talent for the ensemble. Donald Chan's musical direction is pristine and complemented all the performers with sure support. The technical side of this production was superb, led by Lee Savage scenic design, Anne Hold Ward costume design, Brian Nason lighting design, Kevin Kennedy sound design, and Michelle Hart hair, wig, and makeup design. West Side Story runs until December 27th. What a marvelous Christmas gift for someone in your life, or for you. Just call the box office at 941-351-8000. West Side Story was a game-changing theater event. And as Donald says, you get an opportunity here to see the original concept in action. Both Donald and Joey have permission from the Bernstein and Robbins estates to present Leonard Bernstein and Jerome Robbins' original vision. But the only time you're going to get to see it in Sarasota is here, and between now and December 27th at the Oslo Repertory Theater. So, and we're going to go out on yet another of Leonard Bernstein's beautiful ballads. And this is, of course, One Hand, One Heart. So as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show. Something that intrigued you, maybe something that inspired you to ask yourself, are you living the life you were meant to live? Something that will encourage you to run out and see the Oslo production of West Side Story. Or just something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be.
Thank you.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. Going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So